This is the Late Round Podcast with your host, JJ Zacharisa.
What's up, everyone? It's JJ Zacharyson, the editor-in-chief at FanDuel and at NumberFire.com, and this is episode 253 of the Late Round Podcast, one of the many shows that are part of the NumberFire Podcast Network. Thanks for tuning in. Considering I'm doing a few regression-related podcasts this month, I figured I'd answer this question at the top. It came from @shiftworklife, and it says, probably one that you get often, why the term positive regression instead of progression? And it's a very logical question, but the reason to use positive regression instead of progression is because positive regression is telling you that a player or a team or anything, really, is returning to a former state. The term progression tells us that a player is going to perform at a higher level altogether, that he's going to progress and move forward. But that's not what we're talking about here. Positive regression candidates aren't candidates who are going to be better at football. They're players who statistically are going to see their numbers get better without any change in ability. So let's use the golf example that I talked about on my podcast from Tuesday. I'm a low 90s golfer. I play bogey golf. If I have two holes in a row where I triple bogey both of those holes, I should expect my score to positively regress moving forward. On the third hole, I should expect a bogey, the score that I typically get. That's positive regression. If it were progression, then I'd actually be getting better at the game of golf after playing just two holes. We'd be attributing my bogey on the third hole to my ability, not just the fact that shit happens in golf and sometimes you have bad holes. So hopefully that clears things up and makes sense. It's a question, like you said, that I do get a lot. Anyway, today's a mailbag show, and I'll be honest with you guys. Instead of going with the usual 10 or so questions, I ended up answering just 5 this week. Well, 6 if you count the one that I just answered. And the reason for that is because I wanted to get a little bit deeper with some of these questions. They required a little bit more detail to answer. And instead of half-assing them, I figured that you guys would get more out of me really digging in to understand my process. The length of the show is the same as it usually is, so I'm not trying to cheat you guys from hashtag content, I promise you. Before getting to those questions, though, I wanted to let you know that FanDuel's teaming up with RotoGrinders for the annual MLB Single Entry Series. Over the next 6 weeks, they'll be running single entry contests with $64,000 in total bonus prizes. Each week, a new series begins, and your 4 best lineups from that week will count toward the total. The person with the 4 best lineups in a given week will earn a spot in the Single Entry Series Championship for a shot at a $10,000 grand prize, and the top 4 spots each week will all win bonus prizes. To get yourself entered in the Single Entry Series presented by RotoGrinders, go to FanDuel.com or download the FanDuel app. Eligibility restrictions may apply. This first question is from @Mikey_Henninger. Give me some reasons to jump on the OJ Howard hype train. Bruce Arians' offenses are exciting, I get it, but tight end hasn't much been a big part of that to this point. Granted, he hasn't had an OJ Howard type talent. So how much do you manually adjust projections when factoring play caller tendencies? So when you're looking at play caller's tendencies, I think it's a lot more important to look at overall philosophy rather than how these play callers use individual positions. Like Daryl Bevel. We know he wants to be a run-first coordinator. We have evidence that historically, Bevel has had run-heavy offenses. So when you're projecting the Lions, you probably should be projecting them for a lower pass-to-rush attempt ratio than they had last season, at least in neutral game scripts. I'm only going to really care about the individual position level with coordinator data when it's glaringly obvious. Because so often, we create biases when we start associating a coordinator with how he uses a specific position on the field. Back in the day, people used to say that Kyle Shanahan was a great coordinator for his ex-receivers because they were always fed. But he also had Andre Johnson and Julio Jones. You always need that context. But then noise is also created because sometimes there are trends that we think are trends, but then the coordinator does something completely different because either personnel tells him to or the game itself has just evolved. Like, guys, I'll be honest, I don't give a shit how Bruce Arians used Heath Miller. The last time Bruce Arians coached Heath Miller, Andrew Luck was at Stanford. Maybe it's relevant in some way, shape, or form. But is it relevant enough to really move the needle on a projection? You have to ask yourself, how does this coordinator actually change this player's output? The reason you're drafting OJ Howard isn't really Bruce Arians based. It is at the highest of levels. What we know about Bruce Arians is that he likes to throw the football down the field, and that's a good thing for pass catchers. But look at the Tampa Bay situation. They'll likely throw a good number of passes. Those passes will have a high average depth of target. And there's no locked in number 3 pass catcher on that team. That guy is going to be OJ Howard more than likely. So he has a chance to capture a pretty large target share in an offense that will likely be in the top half of the league in pass attempts this year. I think the bottom line is you're going to be a lot more successful in fantasy football when you begin to simplify things. It's fine to understand that certain trends exist. Sure, if you ignore the who, Bruce Arians' tight ends haven't been great. But it's way more important to only factor in the information that will actually move the needle here. Or information that we know will move the needle. And having a vertical offense without a ton of weapons and one that will probably throw the ball a good bit, to combine that with an up-and-coming tight end who was incredibly good when he was targeted last year, that's got the makings of a player with a big ceiling. This next question is from Twitter, and it says, you've mentioned that you're high on San Francisco's offense this year. Any insight on how to best throw darts? I do think that Dante Pettis and Tevin Coleman are the best bets at their respective positions on that team. Obviously, they're the most expensive, but that's for a reason. Considering how Dante Pettis finished 2018, or he had that stretch in 2018, I'm kind of surprised his average draft position isn't higher. I think the reason he's not going higher is because San Francisco got more players this offseason at the position. But none of them are proven. And even if someone like Deebo Samuel emerges, that doesn't mean that Dante Pettis can't live up to his ADP. And don't forget, Dante Pettis was drafted 44th overall in 2018. It's not like Debo's the only one with draft capital on his side on that team. And by the way, I like Deebo Samuel as a player, so this really has nothing to do with Samuel's talent. The way I see it is that Pettis has a legitimately high target share ceiling. If, let's say, Samuel digs into that ceiling, then Pettis is still going to give you some return on your investment. But we're not talking about locked-in guys who are competing with Dante Pettis here. Now, I tweeted this earlier this week, but I would be taking Dante Pettis over Marvin Jones, Corey Davis, N'Keal Harry, and Mecole Hardman. And he's being taken after each of those wide receivers on draft in the month of June. There's target share to be had there. And as I mentioned on Tuesday's podcast, I'm into the San Francisco offense as sort of a lower key target in fantasy. So give me Dante Pettis this year. But to be honest, I also think that Marquise Goodwin has become incredibly undervalued. He's a strong dart throw in best ball as well. And then at running back, I'm cool with all three of those guys. I prefer Breida over McKinnon given cost, but I don't think it's a bad idea to invest in that position whatsoever. Because remember, last year, with very little to work with offensively, San Francisco running backs were fifth in the NFL in total yards from scrimmage. They just couldn't find the end zone because the offense wasn't that great. But now you've got a better offense that's getting Jimmy Garoppolo back, and they should positively regress in the touchdown column. So it's worthwhile to just throw darts at each of those running backs. Even if one doesn't emerge, they should still have usable weeks for best ball purposes. And they're good zero RB candidates as well. This next question says, what is your take on drafting two pass catchers from the same team, like some combo of Godwin, Evans Howard, Thielen Diggs, Juju McDonald, etc.? Does it matter if they're from the same position group? Does scoring format change that? Thanks, JJ. Love the show. So I'll start my answer by providing some data. And this is all wide receiver focused, just to keep things simple. Since 2011, we've averaged a little over one wide receiver teammate pairing in the top 10 per season. Considering there are 32 teams in the NFL, I don't think that's a shocking number by any means. All the while, we've averaged three wide receiver teammate pairings in the top 20. And this is PPR, by the way. Again, that's not very shocking. That means 17 different teams are represented in the top 20 wide receivers each season on average. If you look at the teammates who finished in the top 10 together, most of them were drafted in the top 30 at the wide receiver position heading into a season. Of the 18 players since 2011 to have a teammate in the top 10 with them, only three were ranked outside the top 30 in positional ADP going into that year. And actually, it's the top 27. So what this tells us is that most of these instances are happening with two players who were expected to be pretty good entering the season. Like AB and Juju last year, or Adam Thielen and Stephon Diggs last year, some Packers receivers when Aaron Rodgers was at his peak, and so on. So from that perspective, this isn't bad news for players like Chris Godwin or Calvin Ridley, or any of the Rams wide receivers. But I do think we have to recognize that this still doesn't happen frequently. Like, we're still getting 9 teams represented in the top 10 and 17 in the top 20 at wide receiver each year. So if you're going to draft, let's say, both Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, then you're banking on those guys being that one team. You're banking on the Buccaneers being that team to be in the top 10. And if things actually go south for that offense, then all of a sudden you've got a second and fourth round pick who are now both not living up to ADP instead of just one of those players not living up to ADP. So from that perspective, I generally try to avoid having both on my team. But I'm not doing it at the expense of being suboptimal. Like, if I get Mike Evans in the second round and Chris Godwin lasts to the late fifth round and he's being drafted at like wide receiver 30, then I'll still draft Chris Godwin. But if I'm drafting both players at their ADP, I'll likely avoid Godwin or Howard if I get Evans because I'm placing a lot of faith in one offense with a pair of high-end draft selections. And let's be real, it's an offense that's not as stable as like New Orleans is. But this leads me to my next question. It's from @example0. Why is Chris Godwin's ADP so high? So all of what I just talked about doesn't mean that I'm not drafting Chris Godwin. I still very much like Chris Godwin and think that his ADP is exactly where it should be. Because first, I would say that of all the teammates who could finish in the top 10 together this year, you've probably got Diggs and Thielen first, and I'd put Godwin and Evans second. There are other candidates like guys in Atlanta, Cleveland, both LA teams, Cincinnati, but there aren't 32 teams who have a reasonable possibility of having two top 10 wide receivers this year. But we're also working under the assumption that Mike Evans is a lock to finish as a top 10 wide receiver. There's certainly a world where Chris Godwin digs into Mike Evans' workload more than we think. I'm not saying that he'd outscore Mike Evans, I'm just saying that part of the range of outcomes here is a very close finish between the two wide receivers. And then there's the injury upside piece. Godwin's target share would increase a good bit with an injury to either Evans or OJ Howard. So if that were to happen, Godwin himself has top 10 upside. I can understand if you don't like Godwin at his ADP, but when you're projecting these wide receivers, it's really easy to see Godwin as a top 20 wide receiver this year. Now, it makes sense if you want someone who can become an alpha when you're drafting them in the late fourth or early fifth round. And maybe Godwin doesn't have that opportunity compared to someone like DJ Moore or maybe even Tyler Lockett. But given everything that I just talked about, I think Godwin's cost is very fair. If it rises, maybe I'd come off of him. But I have a hard time seeing that happen without an injury. Right now, my projections have Godwin at wide receiver 23. They've got him with 112 targets, 74 receptions, 996 yards, and 6.5 touchdowns. But that's with a target share that has plenty of room for growth. I'd say that's a fairly conservative projection. He could very easily be placed at about wide receiver 17. So hopefully these last two answers explained where I'm at with Chris Godwin and why I think his ADP is fair. And also, people forget that this is now a Tampa Bay Buccaneers podcast. So there's just one more question this week, and it's from @CFGameBreaker. A few thoughts on Fournette. Half the community seems to be saying he's a screaming value, while the other half is avoiding at current ADP. I'm in the camp that he's a pretty big value. It's hard to find a running back with so much volume upside in the third and sometimes even the early fourth round of drafts. And it's even crazier when you consider running backs are being selected earlier. So Fournette's like a very firm RB2 right now. He's not even a high-end one. There's a great stat from Graham Barfield on Twitter this week, and you guys are familiar with Graham from the show that he did with me last month. But the tweet said, "Leonard Fournette trails only Ezekiel Elliott in touches per game over the last 2 years, while only Todd Gurley has seen more carries per game inside the opponent's 5-yard line than Fournette in this span." Maybe you think that Fournette is in store for a LeSean McCoy type season, or the one that McCoy just had, where he sees a lot of volume, but he's in a crappy situation. Now, I got a lot of things wrong last year. A lot of them. But one thing I didn't get wrong was the LeSean McCoy fade. His ADP was just entirely too high given his situation, despite his volume projection. And then for McCoy, his situation not only sucked, but his volume was just trash as well. So it was a perfect storm for him being a bust. I don't see that happening with Leonard Fournette. Not only do I like his situation more than I like McCoy's, but Jacksonville is due for some positive regression, as I talked about on Tuesday's episode. And Fournette should be locked into a big role on the ground and through the air in that offense. And that's what matters here most. It's really hard to project Leonard Fournette to not see a big workload given the alternatives in that offense. And that's coming from someone who likes Raquel Armstead. So my projections currently have Fournette as RB13 with 256 rush attempts and 59 targets. And I think that target projection can rise as well. That's going to do it for today's show. Thanks to everyone for listening. If you've yet to subscribe to this Tampa Bay Buccaneers podcast, just kidding, the Late Round Podcast, make sure you are by searching for it on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Spotify. And feel free to follow me on Twitter @LateRoundQB. Thanks, everyone. Have a great weekend.